Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm Dalton Del Don, filling in for Scott Pianowski, who's taking a much-deserved vacation, and we'll be back with you next week, so you're stuck with me just once here. I'm excited. I dropped my daughter off for her first day of the first grade this morning. Now I get to talk some baseball with my guest is Derek Carty, creator of the BAT and the Blitz Projection Systems. Thanks so much for being on the show, Derek. How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. I really want to get into the BAT specifically this show, but just want to briefly talk about a couple guys who had some big games over the weekend. First, Lucas Giolito struck out 13 guys Sunday. Man, I was all over this guy last year and then not coincidentally on none of my teams this year just after being burned. What do you make of him? And like, you know, a guy with this pedigree, suddenly the velocity's way up. Swinging strike percentage way up. Actually, I want to get into that later with you. But these crazy peripherals just off the charts. Then he has one really bad month in between two Cy Young type months. What do you make him with Giolito?
I feel like he's one of the toughest guys to like really get a beat on, especially for a projection system. I'm a projection guy, but like he comes with that pedigree, like you said. But in the majors and even in the minors, like his numbers were just so bad. Like he never had a strikeout per nine over seven in the majors up until this year. And like last year, he was just a disaster. And then all of a sudden, he's incredible. And I think, you know, he's made some real changes. Like his delivery is a little bit different. Like his stuff is looking really good. And that's the kind of thing that I think a projection has a tough time getting a feel for, like a drastic change like that. But it does kind of seem to me like there are real changes happening here. And he's finally, you know, making good on the potential prospect people saw, you know, when he was coming up through the minors.
I mean, I'll be kind of the crazy person who'll overrate recency bias and have him as like a top 20 fantasy starter next year or something, because what he's doing is pretty legit this year. But where do you think you will have him? Or do you just go off your projection system, I guess, is a first question, or do you have your own personal ranks, or is it just 100% what that projection system shoots out?
It's probably 95% the projections, because for the most part, anything that I think matters, I want to put into the projections. And there are some things that I know are important that aren't in there yet, or that can't be in there just by the nature of, you know, their qualitative or whatever it is. So I stick pretty closely to my projections, but there are exceptions. And a guy like Giolito, you know, could be one. And hopefully, you know, the kind of stuff that I'm looking to add to it in the future will, you know, better be able to capture a guy like this that just changes so drastically.
All right. And the other guy I want to ask you about over the weekend is Aristides Aquino. I mean, wow. I guess he changed his swing during the offseason. I mean, talk about coming out of nowhere. I added him as a pickups guy in a Friday column, and he was available in just, you know, like two-thirds of leagues in Yahoo. Then he hits three bombs over the week in one game. I mean, obviously, he's playing over his head and all that, but what do you make of him? Striking out a ton, but this is going to lead me to my next question, but I think right now he would actually lead baseball in barrel percentage. I mean, obviously, you're going to have those good under-the-hood stats when you're hitting .452, but still, quite impressive and obviously a small sample, but what are your thoughts on this Reds phenom? The Punisher, I think they call him.
Yeah, I like him. I picked him up in Tout Wars NL last week before this kind of massive explosion, which was really nice. You know, he's obviously performing over his head. Like he has a 30% strikeout rate. He has a 500 BABIP. You know, that's coming down. You know, the guy is going to be, I think, your typical high strikeout, high power guy, but it does look like he has a lot of power. I think that part of it is legit. Not necessarily pacing 90 home run seasons, which I think like his pace right now, but like he's probably, you know, a 40 home run guy, I would think, or even a, you know, maybe more than that, 50 home run guy. Like he's just, his power looks legit.
So I asked you about Giolito and Aquino, two of like the toughest people to project right now. But I just want to get in a more general sense of your BAT projection system. You recently talked about you had a tweet emphasizing exit velocity, launch angle, and barrels, relating it to Josh Bell, I believe. Talk about those stats just in general. I mean, I think they're great, and I love to write about them and use them. I mean, obviously, just fundamentally, you know, they make sense. Hit the ball, who's hitting the ball the hardest, and all that. But you say, you know, it's not quite sticky, as some people probably misuse it a little bit. So talk about this StatCast evolution.
Yeah, so obviously StatCast stuff is exciting and it's great and it's really cool information and it tells us things that we didn't know before about players and all of that is great. I think a lot of times though, people will get too wrapped up in it. They will I've heard some people, you know, talk about it as like all the older stuff we used to use. Those are stats. and the StatCast stuff that we have now, these are skills. And I feel like that's a very like arbitrary distinction, because as much as these StatCast stuff is great, it's not like we can trust them at face value immediately. Like, as good as, you know, Aquino is right now, what his barrel percentage is, which I think you said is like leading the majors, like he's not going to continue leading the majors in barrel percentage, probably. Like, it's going to regress. There is still noise in these stats. There's not a ton of noise. You know, they're fairly stable, but they're not all that much more stable than some of the stats that we had before. Like, people talk about launch angle all the time. Launch angle is basically just a little bit more scientific, quantified version of batted ball information we've had for 20 years, ground ball percentage and fly ball percentage and line drive percentage. It's like, it's basically telling us the same thing. It's just a little bit better. And so it's a little bit more stable, but it's not a lot more stable. And so I think people, like, they see the guy has done this over a small sample size, and then they buy into it completely. And Bell, I think, was the tweet, because like early in the year, he was obviously fantastic and his StatCast numbers were off the chart. But I don't think the smart play was assuming that just because the StatCast numbers were great, now all of a sudden Josh Bell is, you know, one of the absolute best first basemen in baseball. Like, he wasn't going to continue being, you know, Freddie Freeman or Anthony Rizzo. He was probably a little bit worse than that. And I think a lot of people wanted him to be Freddie Freeman. And I don't think that was ever really the most likely thing to happen.
Yeah, I get it. A lot of it is just telling us what has happened and not necessarily what's going to. But I do love the more information. But it is something that I'm probably guilty of overrating myself. How much have you implemented it into your actual, or if have you at all, because, you know, it's only become so widely available the last few years, into your own, into the BATS projection system?
I've definitely started doing it. There's definitely a little bit in there, like exit velocity stuff. I've worked a little bit with sprint speed. And I have plans this offseason. I have kind of a framework in place to like really get a lot more of this stuff in there, because I do think it's important, but I think it's important in the right context and kind of treated the right way. And I think that's kind of the disconnect for some people.
Yeah, I forget the guy's name. The White Sox guy had really interesting numbers last year, and he ended up being a dud. I'm curious about JD Davis right now, because he just jumps out as a guy that's just killing the baseball. I know you're a Mets fan, but what are your thoughts on him? I was going to ask about him later, but I wrote about him as a possible pickup in that same Friday piece. What are your thoughts on Davis?
He's tough, because he's another one of these guys that just like was so terrible for so long. Like last year with the Astros, in like, you know, 100 plate appearances, he had a 2.18 wOBA. Like, he was just absolutely terrible. Like, even in the minors, like, his numbers were okay, but they were never anything outstanding. And especially, you see like a really smart organization like the Astros give up on somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think that tells you something too. So like, seeing what he's doing with the Mets now is just, it's crazy. And I think we do have to buy into it to an extent. And I think when there's a StatCast number supporting it, that is important and it helps us buy into it more. But I'm certainly not buying into JD Davis as a 380 wOBA guy right now, which I think is what he's been doing. Like, I think that's aggressive. I think there is going to be some regression still.
That's fair. All right, I want to ask you about a couple tweets you made about your projection shifts, not even necessarily the players, but players who were traded, but more so the process. So the first one was Mike Leake's projection shift. You have him, his ERA getting worse. And I'm just curious, you know, why would that be? Just a little bit, but going to the National League, is that not, you know, the same as it used to be? I mean, there's still no DH, obviously. The D-backs, I mean, maybe it's just small sample noise, but I mean, you look at Fangraphs, their defense is by far the best in baseball this year. And the Humidor, again, I know you're going to throw the triple S at me, but the Humidor has made this a pitcher's park this year. So explain to me why Leake's ERA projection got worse with this move.
So I didn't get a chance to dig into all of the guys, because it was the trade deadline. There were, you know, a dozen or more than that guys who got traded. And I just kind of looked at what the bat thought before and what the bat thought after, and I tweeted it out. But like, there are a lot of things that can go into it that can make it seem a little different than you would think, especially this time of year. So part of it, I think, is that even though Chase Field is a pitcher's park, and that's very much a pitcher's park, the humor is very much a real thing. It was like,
Talk about that. Is this year has got even crazier, right?
Yeah. And I think last year, like this year, it's definitely played more pitcher friendly than last year. And I think part of it was that last year, it was like a little bit lucky on the hitting side, even like the triples rate was like off the chart last year in Chase Field. And that like wasn't going to continue. You know, the home runs are down. It's about, you know, 15 to 20% below average, which is what we expected it to be based on the science and the math beforehand. So I think we can be very confident in saying that Chase Field is a pitcher's park, and it's a good pitcher's park at this point. But Safeco, where Leake was coming from, right? that's a stronger pitcher's park. So I think that has something to do with it, that even though it's pitcher's park to pitcher's park, there are varying degrees of it. So the bat will look at the varying degrees and that will play a part. I think also something that could easily be influencing it is that the bat looks at projected strength of schedule. And especially this late in the year, you know, at the beginning of the year, you know, it doesn't always completely balance out, but, you know, over 162 games, you know, for the most part, schedules will be somewhat balanced. Over, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, schedules may be completely unbalanced. You know, maybe the Diamondbacks have, you know, a much more difficult schedule than the Mariners would over the rest of the season or something like that. And that could influence a projection like that. I don't know if that's the case, but I'm just kind of guessing.
He was blown up over the weekend, by the way. So I think he gave up 7 earned runs or something. Another thing that you probably factor in that I know I don't is the catcher situation.
Right.
Too. Maybe that was a drastic difference too. But so you were right on the humidor, it looks like. I know you had some blowback on that. But man, that is, would you say it's safe to say that's been even a bigger increase than even you expected?
Honestly, it's been right about where I expected. Last year, it wasn't quite as extreme as I expected. And where the park is projecting right now is pretty close to where I thought it would be originally. And you mentioned catchers. I'm looking like, yeah, Arizona's catchers are not good. Like Alex Avila's catching like every second or third day now. He's a terrible pitch framer. I don't think Carson Kelly is especially good off the top of my head. So that could definitely be playing a part too.
All right. The next one I want to talk about is Zach Greinke, you know, leaving same situation, the good defense and that park. But Houston, do you have any explanation for their secret sauce? They're just really smart, I guess what it is. They're into analytics. And I read that thing about how they sat down Garrett Cole and showed him, you know, we think you're great is why you're showing, why we're showing you all this stuff. Not because we think you're bad, but we think you can be even better. And he just was so receptive to it and eye opening. And now he's, you know, he's just striking out the side every inning, it seems like. So what are your thoughts on Zach Greinke moving there? And also spin rates in general.
Yeah, so it always scares me when the Astros acquire a pitcher because I'm always expecting the bat to be too low on that pitcher because...
Aaron Sanchez already, right? I mean, Aaron Sanchez.
Yeah, and the bat actually liked Sanchez a lot more than other people did. Like in DFS, anytime Sanchez would pitch, everyone would be like, oh, we got to pick on Sanchez. He's terrible. He's the worst pitcher in the world. And I didn't think he was the worst pitcher in the world to begin with. And now he goes to Houston, and I'm pretty sure I saw, you know, his first start, like he stopped throwing his sinker, basically. He threw it like 5 or 10% of the time, which sinkers in general are bad pitches, and I guess his sinker in particular is a bad pitch. And that's just kind of what Houston does, is they really know how to optimize, you know, what their pitchers are working with. They know what pitches work. They know what pitches don't. They know what makes certain, you know, each type of pitch effective. You know, it seems like they work with the pitcher on using their best pitches and even making those pitches more effective somehow. And how they do that second part, that's tough. That's a player development thing. Or if you ask Trevor Bauer, maybe it's something else. But, you know, like there's just, they're definitely doing stuff. And a lot of it is just that they're smart and they kind of know what works. And they're not just using, you know, tried and true, you know, old school things. You know, you have to throw this pitch in this count. You have to do this and this. They're, you know, being objective about things. And they're not, you know, holding themselves to conventional wisdom.
Definitely. And then what spin rate specifically, I know there's some that can be definitely misused, right?
Yeah. So I've done a lot of work myself on pitch types and what makes certain types of pitches effective. And that's something that's definitely going to get incorporated into the bat at some point, which will make it a lot easier for the bat to pick up on Garrett Cole being awesome, you know, when he joins the Astros right away, or Lucas Giolito. You know, he's definitely changed some stuff this year. And I think accounting for pitch type stuff definitely will help us identify these guys quicker. And spin rates, though, like spin rate is something that people love to throw out there. But when you actually look at the spin rate data, at least the publicly available spin rate data, there are certain pitches where it matters a lot, and there's certain pitches where it really doesn't matter much at all. And maybe that's just a matter of the way it's being recorded. And if you like record it more accurately, it will be different. But with the data that we have, spin rate is very, very important for fastballs. It's a lot less important for breaking balls than people want to think it is. Like I know Seth Lugo, when he was, you know, being tried as a starter by the Mets a couple years ago, everyone's like, oh, Seth Lugo has this amazing curveball spin rate, so he's going to be great. But like spin rate doesn't matter a whole lot for curveballs. And then you have the issues with spin rate of there being different types of spin. You have transverse spin, which is spin, you know, in the direction of movement. And you have gyrospin, which is, you know, opposite that, where it's basically like useless spin or deceptive spin or something. And so like if you're breaking it down into the components, it makes it more useful. But like just the spin rate that you see on, you know, Seth Lugo's StatCast page for his curveball, maybe not as important as people tend to think it is.
Yeah, definitely. It makes sense. And I think it could actually be like a detriment, I think, in some cases with the breaking pitches. You mentioned Trevor Bauer, interesting guy. We could talk about him at length, but I'm mainly concerned about your projection shift when it comes to venues affecting strikeouts and walks, which I personally don't use enough in my writing. I should mention that because that I can be up to not as extreme as strikeouts, but you know, up to like what, 10-12%. I think I use the Bill James handbook for this. Is that outdated or is that still all right information as far as park factors?
I think it's pretty solid. They use what, three year park factors in there. That's a pretty decent sample. I think their methodology is, it's not as robust as, you know, one that I will build or something like that. But I think theirs are a pretty good starting point. Yeah.
So how can that do that? Because you tell that to most people and they're just like, what? You're insane that a stadium could affect strikeout and walk rate.
Yeah, you say that to a lot of people and they just write you off and they're making a mistake because they very much do. Stadiums don't impact walks as much as like it's very minimal, the walk stuff. But strikeouts, you know, the top parks are boosting or decreasing strikeouts by, you know, as much as 10 or 15%. And the best example is Coors Field. Coors Field depresses strikeouts by like 15%. And a lot of times people think of Coors Field and they think of it as this great like home run park or whatever. And Coors Field is about so much more than just home runs. A big part of why Coors Field is such an extreme hitter's park is the impact that it has on strikeouts. And it's all about the air density and the altitude of the park. The park is so much higher than every other park in baseball. And when you get to high elevation, the air is thinner. And so when the pitcher throws the ball and it goes towards home plate, it's going to get there quicker first. So there's going to be less time for gravity to act on the ball. And so because there's not as much, you know, air friction or whatever on the ball, it has less resistance going towards the plate. It gets there quicker. It doesn't have as much time to move. It doesn't have as much time for gravity to act on it. And so the balls aren't moving as much, which makes it easier to make contact with the balls, which means fewer strikeouts. And so we see that to lesser extents at, you know, some of the high-ish parks that aren't like, you know, Coors level high.
Like, but the Reds, right?
I think the Reds might be one of them. PNC, Kauffman, I think, is one. They're a Target Field, maybe. There's a few that, like, Comerica, I think, is maybe one that, you know, they're high-ish. And so, you know, they're not decreasing strikeouts by 15% like Coors is, but maybe by 5%. And that can make a difference. That can make a significant difference. And there's other things, too, that affect it. It's not just the altitude, even though that's the biggest one. You know, there are, you know, plenty of other things that can impact it, you know. And a lot of it's just stuff that we can't even necessarily know exactly what's happening. Like ball mudding is a thing. You know, teams have to mud the balls before the game, so we don't know exactly what's happening there. Or, you know, hitter's eye backdrops, you know.
Backdrop, I was going to say,
That can have a big impact on it. All kinds of stuff like that, even if it's, you know, a little bit tough to quantify, it does play into it. And when you run the math on it, we do see that these things are fairly stable, mathematically speaking.
Yeah, I think Bill James is, according to that, the Great American Ballpark's like 11% the last 3 years strikeout rate. So that's
one of the
Bauer.
Best.
Hello, Bauer. While we're talking about strikeout rate, another subject I wanted to ask you about was swinging strike percentage, because I've heard you say that is flawed. I like it. I use it. It definitely seems to me correlate with the best pitchers. That does help. But you think it underrates the pitchers that are good at getting the called strike, right?
That has a lot to do with it. Like you said, there's more than one way to get a strike. And a swinging strike is a great strike. It's more sticky than called strike rate is. But called strikes and foul balls do count as strikes too. And there are certain pitchers or certain types of pitches that are more conducive for generating called strikes than for swinging strikes. And I guess the best example I can probably give is like a curveball. There are multiple types of curveballs. We have, you know, like the Lance McCullers type of curveball where it comes in at like 84 miles an hour and it's like great tunneling. It hides really well inside the fastball. And you get a lot of swinging strikes on that because it's very deceptive. It comes in hard and batters just swing over the top of it. And then you have a curveball like like Rich Hill or maybe like an Aaron Nola. Hill's the best example probably, where I think Hill throws his curveball like 74 miles an hour. Like it's so slow. It's one of those like big loopy 12 to 6 curves. And Rich Hill throughout his career, his swing strike rate has been about average, even though he's one of the best strikeout pitchers in the game when he's healthy. And a lot of that is because of this curveball. You know, he can drop it into the top of the zone for a called strike pretty easily, but he's not generating as many swing strikes on it because of just the nature of his pitch. And Aaron Nola kind of has a similar, you know, a little bit slower, a little bit loopier curve. And he's only been about average, you know, in terms of swinging strikes, but he's a really good strikeout pitcher. And so, you know, swinging strike definitely correlates for sure, but it does have flaws. It does miss certain, you know, certain guys and certain ways of pitching.
Giolito went from 8.3% to 14.5% right now this year. That's insane.
So, I mean, that's nice to see. Yeah. But his strikeout rate is also way up too. Yeah, so like, you know.
Of course. Yeah, yep. Yeah. All right. So juiced balls, I want to ask you. The last stat I believe I came across said that we're on pace for 1,100 more home runs than last season. Is it just me or did the bat make a legit change somewhere for the first 6 weeks in the season, your rest of season? It seemed like all the pitchers got far more pessimistic, or maybe I was looking at the wrong ones on my fantasy team. I don't know. Did you actually make a change to account for the current environment?
I did. So the first couple weeks of DFS this year were terrible for a lot of different reasons, but I do think the ball played a part in it because we didn't, you know, for at least a couple of weeks, we didn't really know that this was happening, or like we didn't know the extent of it. And so about midway through April, I went in, I redesigned the bat to be able to detect changes in the underlying league environment. So it'll be able to see, you know, okay, over X period of time, home run rate is way up or home run rate is way down. And given the stability of league-wide home run rate, it can kind of determine, you know, how much chance there is that that's just kind of like variance and noise and like, oh, it's only been, you know, a couple days, like it doesn't matter yet. And how much of it is real. And so I designed the bat to do that, you know, and then the projections all changed because everyone, you know, gets scaled to the new environment. So about midway through April, it did that. And you definitely, if you're looking at Fangraphs pages, you know, you will have noticed that the bat was, for most hitters, considerably higher than the other systems, and for most pitchers, considerably lower because it was accounting for the new environment.
Yeah. Interesting. I like that. That's good stuff. I'm still curious what Michael Fulmer would have done this year. I was getting him so late in drafts.
And you had I was so excited about him. And you look at what Matt Boyd did. Like, the bat was super high on Matt Boyd. And everyone's like, why Matt Boyd? Like, what do you see in this guy? But like,
Spencer Turnbull. I mean, hasn't been great fantasy-wise, whatever, because of the wins. But that guy's been a solid player. And he really has. The bat was on him before, too. So, like the Tigers. All right, so I'm going to ask you a couple of specific guys. I'm not going to only give you ones you got right, but I just remember, I think it was Draft Cheat giving you a hard time, the Twitter guy. Funny guy, I don't know him, but I remember him giving you a hard time about Blake Treinen and multiple people probably give you a hard time about Germán Márquez. About Márquez. So Treinen, I mean, came out of nowhere last year, so I get the track record. I mean, not out of nowhere, but you called for regression. Wow, has that hit? And wow, Márquez. I mean, it's just simple. It's pointing to Coors Field.
It really was. And that's why I was so surprised. Not only that Márquez was being taken as high as he was in drafts, he was taken on average, I think, as like the 25th starting pitcher off the board. But that when I would like say like, hey, guys, can we think about this for a second? Isn't that too high? People would just freak out. They'd be like, no, he had a great second half and he started using his slider more. And it didn't, you know, Coors Field doesn't matter because in the second half last year, after he started making all of his drastic changes, he was great in Coors Field. So now he's figured Coors Field out. Like, that's not a thing. That's just not a thing. Over time, pitchers will always lose to Coors Field. There's ways to kind of mitigate it a little bit. But in order to justify Márquez being the 25th starting pitcher off the board, as a pitcher in Coors Field, you actually had to think Márquez was like a top five pitcher in baseball, that he was like, you know, Max Scherzer, Gerrit Cole, Justin Verlander level of talent. And I think that was really, really aggressive to try to say after half a season of him, you know, being really good. And we've seen it this year. Like, I think he's actually getting a little bit unlucky this year. But a lot of it, too, is he's pitching in Coors Field. And Coors Field is a really tough place to pitch.
Totally. All right. So I won't harp on Fernando Tatis Jr. too much, but I want to give you a hard time about how difficult really it is, honestly, to project these young talents. And basically, I want to point to Jordan Alvarez. And mm-hmm. where What do you make of him? I know that you were not, Chris Liss has brought up to me that you were not as aggressive as you thought you should be on your projection with him. Okay, it's one player, whatever, and Tatis is going nuts. He's going to be maybe a first-round fantasy pick next year. But there are a lot of misses. I mean, Austin Riley looked like a superstar for a little bit, and then his plate has been clawed up to him. And there are a bunch of other misses I'm sure you'd be happy to point out that people thought there'd be stars. But Alvarez specifically, through 200 plate appearances, can you guess what his WRC plus is right now?
Is it like close to is it close to 200? It's got to be really high. Like
it's 204.
Jeez. Yeah, he's been incredible.
So what do you make of these guys? You, by the way, have the highest right now projected WRC plus, 144, higher than Steamer 130 and Zips 127. So props, maybe I shouldn't be giving you as hard of a time here. Honestly, though, what do you make of these crazy, phenoms coming out of nowhere, but just putting up video game type numbers in the minors?
So the bat actually did really like Alvarez, by prospect standards, at least when he got called up. I think I put a tweet out and it wound up being, the projection at the time, I think it said he was going to get, 12 or 13 home runs the rest of the season, which I think he's already
that's
passed,
a good weekend. Yeah, that's
that.
A week. That's a week.
Yeah, but it was like a 350 or 360 wOBA, which for a rookie hitter is a really good projection. And he's just been way better than that. And it's tough because when you are projecting prospects or projecting anything in general, like people, when they talk about prospects, they want to think about the upside and how great they could be. But a projection is basically an average of all possible scenarios. So yeah, it's going to consider how great he could be. It's also going to consider that he could be Byron Buxton or Yoan Moncada or Dansby Swanson or someone who, came up to the majors, even if they were a really highly regarded prospect and didn't do a whole lot right away. And so that's what a projection is. It's looking at all the possible paths and it's considering what they did in the minors and it's saying, okay, this is probably most likely, but there's always the chance that these prospects, are going to be huge. There's no process out there that's able to identify these prospects are going to be amazing and these prospects are going to be busts. Like it's just, you can't do that with 100% accuracy. So you try to do the best you can. And Tatis really is the one. I've been so vocal about it because Tatis, like every projection system, hated coming into the year. Like didn't just think he was going to be okay. Like legit hated him. I thought he was going to be like a well below average hitter because his minor league numbers really weren't all that good.
He's so young too.
And
people
he was
don't
so
do
young.
That.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you look now and I still, every time he does something, I get tweets from people, oh, Tatis is so good. You look really bad. But like, you look at Fangraphs right now, the bat is easily the highest on Tatis. The bat thinks Tatis is really good at this point. And you look at some of the other systems who I have all the respect in the world for. I think they're doing great stuff. I'm not like, this isn't like me insulting anyone else. But like, you look at Steamer and Zips, they still have Tatis as a league average hitter. Pakoda has Tatis as a sub-replacement level player. Like, that's insane. And it speaks to how difficult it is to project prospects because, of how much they bust and how much, minor league numbers are, a little bit of an inexact science,
Totally. Alvarez or Freddie Freeman next year fantasy draft?
I'm still taking Freddie because I love him, but the bat loves Alvarez. The bat thinks Alvarez is like a top 20 or 25 hitter in baseball at this point, which he's obviously been better than that, but regression and whatever else, like it's still a very impressive, I feel like, rookie projection.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. Yeah. I try to pick someone who also doesn't get steals, but man, as far as I'm just so in on this guy, hopefully that's bulky knee doesn't become a chronic thing. Cause he's just so fun to watch play baseball.
He really is. He's great.
Okay. I have Cardi on the podcast here. I'd be remiss not to bring up DFS. I just really want to leave the floor to you and talk your personal strategy, how your year's been this year. How do you build lineups? Do you start with the pitchers? Just go.
The biggest thing for me is I'm a cash game player. I'm not a GPP player. I'm not out there trying to bink, $100,000 pots every night. I'm content to try to, grind it out, make a small profit over the course of the season, little by little. And so in cash games, it's sort of started to change. Like the philosophy has started to change. Other people are doing this, but I mean, for years, my thing has always been, you don't need safety. People always try to talk about how you need safety in cash games because you only have to beat half the people. So you don't have to swing for the fences. Like you don't have to do anything crazy. Just play, pay up for the aces and play the safe plays and don't play, Joey Gallo in cash games. And that's never been a thing for me. Like the way you win cash games is to play the best players. And that sounds very simple. And it is. Like, that's it. Just play the best players. Have a system or whatever, a process that identifies the best players and play those guys. It doesn't matter if they're risky. It doesn't matter if they're bad. Like, I'm looking at the slate tonight and I'm probably going to wind up playing Austin Pruitt or Brock Stewart, and they're terrible. And I'm going to play it in cash games because I think that's the right thing to do, because pitching in general is terrible tonight and there's a lot of offense that I want. And so I think making those types of plays, people are still afraid to do, not as much as they used to, but I really think it gives such a big edge, you know, being willing to make those kind of plays, because it's not about, you know, mitigating your losses tonight or you know, trying to not lose tonight. It's about trying to win as much as possible over an entire season, and variance will even out.
So talk about weather in DFS. How much do you factor that in when you're building your lineups? And I know there's some really good stuff out there, man. It's just getting better and better. And also when you talk about your cash lineups, I've just imagined that also dealt more with when there used to be more dead money. It seems to me like people are getting smarter and smarter. So it does make more sense to not necessarily take some risks when it comes to cash.
For sure. People are getting smarter. You know, there's still plenty of edge, but people are definitely getting smarter. But there are edges to be had. Weather is a big one. You know, weather, people are starting to take into account more than they used to, but still probably not as much as they should. You know, weather is a big deal.
Yeah, you're not just looking at postponements, you know, I mean, you're looking at just
right.
Very
no, I'm talking
little,
about yeah. like, you know, temperature and humidity and air density and wind and all kinds of stuff like that. And it can make a big difference. You know, a lot of times people will look at, you know, two pitchers, and on the surface, it'll look like, you know, they're in comparable matchups. They have comparable salary. But, you know, maybe one of them is, you know, Madison Bumgarner in San Francisco, especially this time of year. Madison Bumgarner, he's pitching at home in San Francisco. It's 60 degrees there. Everywhere else on the slate, the other pitcher you're thinking about, all the other pitchers on the slate, it's 85 degrees or 90 degrees. And that's a huge difference. If you're, you know, getting a guy in, you know, 20 degree or 25 degree cooler temperatures than everywhere else, that is going to give him a big relative boost, because these things do really matter.
Man, do you think my Giants were dumb not dealing Bumgarner?
Probably. I mean, I don't think they're really standing much of a chance of making it to the postseason. You know, I think get something for him while you can.
Yeah,
you know?
I can see their reasoning why not. And I'm glad to hear that you're not just so dogmatic about, of course, it was the worst decision ever, because it certainly looks worse after their record ever since the trade deadline. They've just been falling off. But okay, so back to DFS. And another thing I really want to ask about is lefty-righty splits. Do you think the community in general overrates this?
I don't think, well, I think they mistreat it more than anything else. These are very important. You know, everyone knows lefties hit righties better, righties hit lefties better. And I think people, the mistake that people make is they try to look at the individual player's splits. You know, they look at, you know, well, this guy this season has a 500 wOBA against lefties, and so he's a lefty masher, and I got to play him when he plays lefties. And these splits have so much noise in them, like way more noise than anyone will ever believe you. When I tell somebody that a right-handed batter's platoon splits take 10 full seasons to stabilize, they just laugh. They're like, no, that's not possible. It doesn't matter. But like, it does. It's literally been proven, you know, as much. It's kind of funny and kind of ironic, because like, the first place that I ever saw that like showed this and proved this was a book called The Book, Playing the Percentages in Baseball.
Oh, yeah. Great.
By Tango, MGL, and Dolphin. Now Tango is working for Major League Baseball. He's creating all these cool StatCast things that people love. But this work that he's done in the past that says, guys, platoon splits, like, don't look at individual hitter platoon splits. People just ignore it. Like, it's the same guy. It's the same process. It's the same, you know, mathematical lean. So the bat will look at the individual splits, but it will regress them according to the sample size. And a lot of times that means regressing them very heavily because they're very noisy. So unless you're doing the full math, if you're using lefty-righty splits, just use a blanket rule for everybody. All righties are better against lefties. All lefties are better against righties. And that's it. There's no such thing as a reverse splits hitter.
Right,
like,
yeah,
that doesn't exist.
That next. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's just small sample. Anytime you see that,
it's small sample noise. It will regress going forward. He'll start being better against the opposite hand going forward. There are a few guys that are maybe borderline. Maybe you can sort of call them neutral splits guys, but like, true reverse splits hitters really don't exist.
Yeah, you bring up Tango. You know, I'm getting frustrated with all the awesome baseball writers getting scooped up and hired by actual teams and missing their writing. It's been frustrating, but an obvious solution and smart one by teams. What about umpires? Are we still just in the baby stages of this, or is that factoring in to your decision-making on a nightly basis?
Yeah, umpires are definitely factored in. They matter. They're not like a massive factor, but they make a difference. You know, a really good pitcher's umpire will give a considerable advantage over, you know, a really good hitter's umpire. You know, we're talking maybe a couple DFS points, But, you know, because we are talking about probabilities, because we are talking about, you know, maximizing the number of points we're scoring over the long run, over time, that does add up. It does convey an edge, and we do want to consider them.
All right. Totally makes sense. I want to ask you about the robot umps. What about that? Thoughts on robot umps?
No, absolutely not.
What? Really? Really? Oh, because you'd lose. I know why you're going to say that. Actually, I know why you're going to say it. Go ahead.
You know exactly why, because yeah, I'm going to lose
our advantage. Yeah.
Like, I'm sure for, you know, a baseball fan, maybe they want to see all the right calls be made. I don't want that, because I like an umpire that has a little bit of discretion, wiggle room with what he can call. And because we can quantify that, and we can say this guy is more likely to give the pitcher the call, this guy's more likely to give the hitter the call. And that's going to give us an edge over our opponents who aren't considering that. And if we use robot umps, then that edge goes away. We're all doing the same thing.
Okay, totally. I like it. I like that. I like that that angle. What is your strategy going to be for fantasy drafts next year before we get into our fun draft here soon? I went crazy this year. Unfortunately, my flight got totally delayed and I wasn't able to go with you in labor.
That's
in Arizona
right.
This
that
year. It's horrible. But I went just really bizarre in my strategy this year, and I went 15 rounds without taking starting pitchers in the main event, NFFC. And again, this is the year when hitters are going crazy, but I just did not draft the right hitters. It seems like I hit a lot of the Matt Boyds, Caleb Smiths, but whatever reason, my teams have just been mostly okay this year. A, how has your fantasy team been doing? And B, is your strategy going to be any different next year knowing the environment we're using? And who knows if the balls are going to change back?
That's the biggest thing. Like, I'm so not looking forward to having to project next season because, like I said, I set the bat up to be able to detect when there's a change in the environment, and it can do it fairly quickly. You know, less than a week's worth of games, we should be able to have a pretty solid, you know, example of what the league's playing like.
Yeah, people say it's a small sample, but it's not a small sample of balls in play.
Right. No, it's not at all. And so going into next season, even though it only takes a couple games to know, we're not going to have those games.
Yeah,
like, we're
exactly.
Not going to know ahead of time what the ball is going to be like. Is Major League Baseball going to change it? Is something else going to happen? Because we've seen three or four years in a row now where there's been pretty drastic differences in the underlying league environment from year to year. And so whichever system is able to nail that is going to be in great shape, I think. And I'm not looking forward to trying to have to do that.
Yeah, no, for sure. All right. One last thing I was going to ask you. Do you have any predictions for real baseball outcomes? I have got the Twins at 60-1 to win the World Series before the season. I've been bragging about that to anyone listening
to
me. And man, lost 3 out of 4 of the weekend to Cleveland, who seemingly lost all of their starting pitchers yet are now tied for first. So that's kind of driving me crazy. But obviously, I'm confident Minnesota, the huge run differential. Loving that. So they're my favorite team because the Giants are obviously not a chance. And I got them at 60-1. So do you have any hot takes, or do you think it's just going to be Yankees, Houston, or what are your thoughts on the World Series prediction?
Yeah, I still like Minnesota over Cleveland. You know, I thought Cleveland was underperforming earlier in the year. I'm not surprised they've been better. I do think at this point, Minnesota is probably the better team. And so I would expect them to win, but obviously it's close and could go either way. I'd be surprised if it's not a Houston Yankees ALCS series because they're just so much better than everyone else, especially if the Yankees can get healthy. So obviously that's not really going out on a limb.
Yeah, Dodgers. And then on the other side, I mean, they just unbelievable. Their farms. I mean, Gavin Lux, can I just ask you about him? Are you stashing him? Do you think they moved him to second base? This kid's, I don't think he can drink alcohol and he's just raking like out of control. And it's seemingly, I was a Giants fan. It's been like this for a decade. They just have another guy down the pike every other week, an awesome prospect. It's infuriating.
Yeah, it really is. And good organizations, they just do that. So, yeah, I mean, he's going to be exciting, I think, when he comes up. And it will probably be a situation where I'm projecting him lower than people want me to. But, you know, there's that big upside.
yeah, for sure. All right. So your prediction for the World Series is?
I think Houston, LA is the easy one. You know, if I'm looking at like a sleeper team, like I think the Nationals are a lot better than people, you know, think they are. I've been saying that for a long time. Now they actually have, you know, they're in a wild card spot right now. So if they could win that game, I think they can make some noise.
Nice. Please, Soto's ankle not be hurt. That guy's the man.
Yes.
what a talent. All right, cool, man. Thanks. Awesome talking baseball with you, Cardi. We'll now transition to our fun, silly draft. I have to keep Pino's tradition alive. Earlier I did my favorite TV shows with P&L of all time. I've watched too much TV working from home in the background. So that's what I came up with this time, a variation of that, current TV shows. So it doesn't have to currently be airing. That would actually be tough, but just hasn't been canceled or hasn't ended. So we're going to go with that. And I'm going to give you, my guest, Derek Carty, the first pick on your favorite current TV show.
Yeah, I used to watch so much TV and I don't watch as much as I used to, but I think Billions is going to have to be my first pick. Like, Billions is one show that, even though like my time for TV now is limited, I make it a point to watch Billions because it's just so good, and it's going into, or it just finished, I guess, like its third or fourth season. And it feels like it just keeps getting better.
Billions is such a fun show, and I love how they implement food into it a lot. And it's super, it's one of the shows that I look forward to watching the most, and it just flies by. I'm actually going to piggyback here and make my first choice a show that's could be comparable. I'd say Billions meets Game of Thrones, and it's Succession. I put it number one on my list last year, and actually had its season premiere last night. It's about a media conglomerate family, and it's just definitely over the top in the same vein as Billions, and just super entertaining HBO show. Season premiere season two last night. So Succession right now is a show I'm really looking forward to, and very kind of similar to Billions. So
I've never even heard of this, so I'm gonna have to watch this show.
Check out Succession. Yeah, I'm gonna have some off the wall ones, just to be clear here. So that if you think that one's off the wall, that you're not just just wait here. So what's your next one, Carty?
I'm gonna go with It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, because it's another show where, like, I love that kind of sense of humor. I think it's hysterical. And it's another show that, even though it's been on now for, what, like 13 or 14 years, it feels like they just keep finding new ways to be funny and new ways to, you know, to one-up themselves and to be better. Like, it's not like one of these shows that dries out or you know, kind of recycles the same type of stuff. And sometimes they will actually do that a little bit intentionally. Like it's a very self-aware show. I love Always Sunny.
Absolutely love it. It was on my list. I'm a big comedy fan, even though my first couple picks aren't going to show that. I love comedies. And you said it. Unbelievable. Seasons 13 and 14 might be their best two. That's just so crazy.
It's crazy.
And like, it never happens. Shows usually run its course after three or four, and then there's repeating material. It's so funny. That dancing sequence at one of the finales a couple years ago, just incredible, man. I mean, they're actually dealing with real life material too. It can be the silliest on one aspect, but honest to God, you know, handling real life issues pretty well too. So love that show. My second pick is Better Call Saul. Talk about degree of difficulty. Following up Breaking Bad, I just thought was a terrible idea, but I should have never doubted Vince. And I'd actually argue this is a slower paced show, but I'd argue it's superior to Breaking Bad. I mean, it's just done so, so well, the acting, and I just can't wait to see how it winds up. So Better Call Saul is my second pick. Carty, you're up for number three.
This one might be a little out there, but have you ever watched Cobra Kai? It's like...
Absolutely. I love it. I put it on my top 10 list season one last year, and I enjoyed season two. I didn't think it was as good, but I'm totally down with Cobra Kai.
So I haven't had a chance to watch season two yet, but I love season one. And like, it's just, it's so cool. Like the old Karate Kid movies are like fun and goofy. And I feel like this picks right up where they left off. And it's even better. Like, it has heart, it has humor, it's great. Like,
oh yeah, it's streaming YouTube. I'd never done that, but I actually was never even a Karate Kid movie guy as a kid. I mean, I saw it, whatever. It was not something that I had some special memory of, but people that I respected implored me to watch it, and I couldn't agree more. Like, I watched far too much TV, and I had it in my top 10 last year. It was far better than in any business being. So totally with you on Cobra Kai. My next one's going to be probably one that most people have not heard of, but it's, I believe it's on Amazon Prime. It's called Fleabag. Season one came out years ago, but season two just came out this year, and you could even skip season one if you wanted. It's just six episodes, about 25 minutes each, so you could fly through it. The main protagonist falls in love with a priest, and it's done. It's pretty much perfect. It's my number one show so far in 2019, called Fleabag. Derek, you're up for number four.
I feel like this one's kind of a cop-out, but Stranger Things, like everyone loves Stranger Things. The first season was obviously fantastic. The second season, I kind of didn't really like that much, so I wasn't excited when the third season came out a few weeks ago. And then I watched it, and I was like, oh my God, season three is amazing. Like, it just, season two, it felt like it was, you know, playing it a little bit safe, kind of trying to do the same thing as season one. And season three just like did its own thing, like went off the rails. There's like a whole like Russian spy like subplot. Like, it was just great.
Enjoy Stranger Things, one of the best shows to binge these days. You're too young to even get any of the references, but yeah, totally entertaining show. No argument here. I'm really going to go off the wall with my next pick. It's a show called I'm Sorry. It's on True TV. It's this comedian named Andrea Savage, and it's filmed in the very same vein as Curb Your Enthusiasm. Curb would have obviously been my number one pick here. It's my favorite show of all time, that and Seinfeld, but I already picked it when I did the P&L one, so I'm trying not to repeat here. So a show called I'm Sorry on True TV. It's had two seasons, and if you're a fan of that type of humor like Curb, highly recommend that. Derek, you're up next.
This is the last pick, right?
Last pick, yes, here's the last pick.
It's tough because there's still a lot that I feel like I could go with here. You said earlier you're like a big comedy guy. I like comedies too. They're easy to watch, especially like they're, you know, half hour shows. So you don't have to, you know, devote a ton of time to them. The Good Place is, I feel like, really, really good. You know, I don't watch a whole lot of like network shows or network comedies, but the Good Place is just fantastic. I think it's Ken Tremendous, the guy who used to be like a sports critic type guy. I think he's actually the one who like runs the show and writes it. And it's just, it's so clever. It's so witty. It's so funny. Like the acting's great. I just love The Good Place.
And we're copying Ken Tremendous here. We're paying homage, actually. He and Joe Poznanski have a podcast where they do their own draft at the end in this vein. So yeah, so it's good. I love him. Yeah, he's a great comedy writer. All his shows, Back from the Office and all that, Parks and Rec, Good Place. Yeah, one of my wife's favorite shows. So great pick there. Yeah, I thought of a couple. You said comedies like Big Mouth, BoJack Horseman are funny comedies. They're cartoons. Atlanta's a great show, and Euphoria was certainly watchable this season. But the last one I'm going to say is Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. You know, I really don't want, I'm not really into too many politics shows, but this is just so smart and it's delved into such deep and interesting topics this last year. I'm just going to take it with my last pick. It's just so, so smart. And he doesn't talk down to you. And it's just a real interesting way to take in politics. So that would be my last pick, but some good choices here. And Derek, man, I had a lot of fun talking baseball with you. I learned a lot myself, and thank you to producer Brett and to Scott Pianowski for letting me fill in one time. I hope I didn't totally blow it. And so you've been listening to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and thanks for listening.